Hi there. This is Nick Savvides. You're listening to the NSavvides podcast. This is a show where we talk about the art of collaboration, of doing great, creative, imaginative things and doing those things well with others. Our guest today is Hunter Vai. He's been the editor for TV and film projects like The Mist, The Hundred, Sons of Anarchy, Mob City, and Preacher, but he's probably best known for his work on The Walking Dead. He was the editor for The Pilot and many of the other iconic episodes for that esteemed series. In this episode, we talk about the role of the editor and how he works with the director, the visual effects department, assistant editors to shape the project. It really is a big part of storytelling up there with the director and the writer of a project. So we discuss that. We talk about the difference of working, editing a TV show versus a film and the challenges that come with that, the importance of play in a creative project. And then we look at some of the specific editing choices that Hunter has made on some of his projects, including The Walking Dead pilot, The Mist, and Preacher. Now, The Walking Dead, it's been out for a while. You've probably seen it. The Mist as well. We don't go into that too much as far as story, but, you know, heads up. We do go into the story of season one finale of Preacher quite a bit. So if you haven't seen it yet, you might consider seeing it just as a bit of a warning. It's a bleak finale. So just be aware, maybe not the thing that you want to watch during the holiday season, or maybe it is. I don't know. But I'll give you a heads up when that part comes up so you can pause the episode if you're so inclined, or listen. We talk a little bit about the show, and it's not for everyone, so you can listen and figure out if that show is something you want to catch. Without further ado, our interview with Hunter Vai coming up next. Stick around.
This is the NSavvides podcast. Hello, hello, hello.
Hunter Vai, welcome to the NSavvides podcast.
Ah, thank you. It's great to be here talking with you.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you got into editing.
You know, when I was a kid, I always kind of played around with my dad's video camera and stuff. And then when I got into high school, I was terrified of getting up and doing public speaking for like book reports or for presentations. And I would talk to my teachers and see if they would let me do video projects instead. And they usually would. They'd usually let me do it and wheel in the TV cart and show some video presentation that usually starred me. Mm-hmm. But that I was okay with. I was okay with that instead of getting in front of the class. And that kind of started this idea of wanting to get into this. And when I was in college, I joined a TV station. We had this little tiny TV station. It was just three people in a closet. And we had public access. They would let us air like a 30-minute show on public access in Charleston, South Carolina. And out of necessity, I started editing, and I kind of built my own little nonlinear computer editing system. I spent $900 on a 9-gig hard drive. That's how long ago this was.
Yeah, I mean, that's big money back then. And 9 gigs, I'm sure, must have been huge, right?
Oh, it was huge. It was like, oh my gosh, it's 9 gigs. It's crazy. And we were just doing these little things, and I kind of fell in love with it. And I fell in love with the idea of taking all these different pieces and kind of stitching them together to create something. And before I was editing it, it was just this raw footage. And then, you know, you kind of take it and you compile it and you have an opinion on it and you put music behind it or whatever. And these were like little like news stories, little silly news stories we were just having a blast doing. I knew after that's really what I wanted to get into. And so I went to a school called Full Sail in Orlando, Florida, knowing that that's what I wanted to do. And they just had such great access to gear and stuff. And went down there, fell in love with it, moved out to LA with a couple of friends. And I got very, very lucky and got this internship with the American Cinema Editors and met some people there that were just awesome. And one of them was this woman, Lori Coleman, and she brought me onto my first union show called The Shield. And I was an assistant editor on that show for 2 seasons. And the third season, they promoted me and the other assistant. They bumped us both up to editor. And I've been very fortunate to have been editing ever since then.
Sounds like quite the story. And I'm intrigued that it started all the way back from high school book reports, right?
It started out of fear.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to get up in front of people. So still to this day have that fear.
So for those who don't know, tell us a little bit about the assistant editor role compared to what the editor will do generally.
Unfortunately, the assistant editor role has kind of changed over time. There used to be much more of like an apprenticeship, mentorship part of it. And I believe very strongly in doing that. But the core level of what an assistant does is data management. I mean, it's pulling in the media as it's coming in because, you know, everything is shot digitally now or transferred digitally, even if they do shoot film. Like The Walking Dead, I believe, still shoots film. They shot film at least the first few seasons. But everything after that is still completely, it's just hard drives. And it's pulling in the media and grouping clips. If they shoot two cameras, it's syncing all that media together. And then it's a lot of turning over to visual effects and turning over to sound once we've locked the picture. And it's just a lot of data management and communicating with the post side of things. Because I consider editorial to be different than post because we are part of production. We are brought on. We are there from the first day of shooting until the last day of shooting and then beyond. And then we work with the post team. And the assistant editor in the TV world is really a person who navigates both the post side of things and the editorial side of things. On the feature side of things, there's usually a first assistant on something that has a reasonable budget. There's going to be multiple assistants. And there's a first assistant that really is much more of like an organizer and a scheduler and a manager that delegates responsibilities out to the other assistants. But I mean, in TV, which is where I've been doing a lot of my work lately, the assistant really has to answer to the editor and answer to the post side of things. It can get to be a little crazy. What I enjoy about it as an editor is working with assistants that want to edit and letting them do that and edit. And then I'll edit the scene and they'll edit a scene. And then we can sit down and discuss like, hey, you found this great moment that I missed, or hey, this is the way that I was looking at the scene. Maybe you can give that another shot looking at it from that point of view. And I do want there to be that mentorship. In fact, I'm very proud of many of my assistants have moved up and gone on to become editors and are out there being very successful right now doing that now.
Yeah, that speaks well for you as opposed to them leaving the industry. They now work selling paper or something, managing some hotel chain. So
That's right. Yeah. No, hopefully it's not too brutal working with me.
Right. So that's a plus. All right. Well, it sounds like you get to work on all kinds of projects. Ideally, what's your workflow like?
Well, I mean, in a perfect world, like the way that something that I have found that helps me to edit quicker, that's really kind of helps, been a big breakthrough for me. I used to edit and think, there is one right way to cut this scene, and it's up to me to find it and to not mess it up. And what I've come to realize is that there's actually lots of different ways to cut a scene, and it's okay to take risks or gambles and try something different, especially during my part of the phase when I'm just editing it alone in my room. And then I just kind of move on. So, maybe I'll jump cut the scene, or maybe I'll try the scene, you know, telling it from a different actor's point of view than you would necessarily think that you would. And it's okay to like have the freedom to kind of do those things, especially during like the editor's cut. And then in the very end of it, I like to spend in TV, I like to spend a couple days at least like assembling it and putting it together and then looking at it and going, oh, that's why this moment is important here. Let me like readjust this scene to better tell that story that pays off down, you know, 20 minutes later or an hour later or whatever. And it's not until you kind of get the whole thing together that I really sit down and go, okay, here's really what we're doing. Until then, it's kind of just like a loose bag of stuff that's just kind of out there. And, you know, but what it did was it really gave me the freedom to like try weird stuff and different stuff and not feel like, and know that it's okay to take a risk and to be wrong. And I feel like in doing that, I've become a much better storyteller. So that's where I kind of am now with it. And it's taken me, probably a decade to get there. It took me a little while to get there, but it's fun. It's fun being able to take a risk and not be afraid to make a mistake.
Yeah. And it sounds like getting a little bit of time to play is helpful and it gives some discovery opportunities.
100%. Yes. Yes. You have to have, I mean, obviously there's schedules and there's deadlines, but it's nice to be able to have a little bit of time to play with it. And I find that directors and producers usually are very receptive to that, to allowing the editor to have the time they need with the material. At least ones that are experienced realize that that discovery process only benefits them further on down the road as well.
Just so we get some sense of your editing sensibilities, is there a film you haven't worked on that you really admire the editing for it? And if so, why?
I love sound. Sound to me is a huge part of what we do as filmmakers. And I think it's a huge part of this medium that we have. And so that being said, I adore movies like Contact and movies like The Thin Red Line.
Ooh, interesting choices.
Those are kind of like where I will go back to for inspiration. And those are movies that I think have very strong visual senses and directors that are very, very strong visually. The Thin Red Line is something to me, it's not like a literal narrative to me that I fell in love with. I like the fact that it was a little bit loose and a little bit impressionistic in a way. Those are the moments, at least, that like really stood out to me. I just saw Arrival and was really similarly moved by that. I found that that actually had a similar usage of sound and music and the visual storytelling that was a little bit more, very mature versus something that's just like an action movie for the sake of being an action movie. In Arrival, there's a moment where our two leads that we're following, our two heroes that we're following, are in a space and they hear something terrible happening below. There's this gun battle that's taking place, and we never go down to see the carnage that's happening. We simply stay up with our people as they're reacting to it. You know, sometimes leaving it up to the imagination is a lot more impactful than actually going and seeing it all. And I'm a huge horror fan. In horror, you edit to make it scary, like no matter what, like it has to be scary. Like if you're doing comedy, it has to be funny. So you sacrifice everything for that. Getting to edit that is a lot of fun because you're like, okay, now I'm challenged to like make this scene that's like, otherwise it's just like, you know, people walking around in a house. Like, how do I make it scary?
Right. As opposed to doing like the art house scene of it where it goes on indefinitely and people are like, what is the point? What is the meaning?
Well, then that's also fun.
Yeah.
The variety is what's fun.
All right. So let's talk about some of your specific projects. You mentioned horror. Your first collaboration with Frank Darabont, as far as I know, is on The Mist.
Well, he and I actually did an episode of The Shield together, which is where we met.
All right.
Yeah. He apparently was a big fan of the show. And well, apparently I know this. He was a big fan of the show and ended up at a dinner with the showrunner and one of the producers and ended up accepting the challenge to come and direct 7 days and make 1 hour of television. And I was very lucky and got that episode. And he and I became friends, and I've become his editor since then and a good friend of his since then.
All right. So tell us a little bit about the collaborative process for The Mist.
Well, it's funny. When we started The Mist, they shot that in Shreveport, and I was living in Atlanta at the time. And so I packed up my stuff and drove to Shreveport and met with him as they were prepping the sets and all that kind of stuff. And then our cutting rooms were in Los Angeles. So I actually drove cross country, stopped in as they were prepping the sets, getting ready to go into production. He and I sat and talked about the script and stuff. And then I hopped back in my car and we drove out to LA and I got my cutting room up and running there. And on that movie, I ended up with like 4 assistants at any one time. We had a visual effects editor and 3 assistants. Since we were in, and this is very common, you know, to have your cutting room in one place and in production another. So, you know, we were constantly having to communicate with Shreveport and make sure that we were up to date with that.
As far as checking the dailies and conveying notes and that kind of thing?
Yes. Because we had these big, one of the things on this show, on that, one of our bigger challenges on that one was we had a very large visual effects sequence that was reimagined on the day that they were shooting it, and the storyboards were thrown out.
Ah, that's living dangerously, huh?
Yeah, it became a thing. And so in order to make our release date, we had to lock this sequence while they were actually still shooting the movie. And so I packed up a laptop and flew out to Shreveport. They wanted me to be as close to Frank as possible while he was shooting. And the only space available on the sound stage is where I could possibly set up an editing room according to the producers, was in the women's bathroom.
Nice.
Yeah. So there was this little antechamber to the women's bathroom, and that's where they put me. And they actually put up a sign that said, this is no longer the women's bathroom. This is now Hunter Vi's office. And I didn't know they'd put the sign up. And I hear this woman outside reading the sign, laughing, saying, there is no Hunter Vi. This is a joke. This is a joke, right? And I open up the door, and there is Academy Award winning actress Marcia Gay Harden, who then referred to me as bathroom boy.
That's a nice way to meet her, huh? Like, way to make a first impression on her.
Yeah. So from there on out, I was bathroom boy.
All right.
Which was pretty funny. But then after that, I hung out there for a couple of weeks, and they moved me into more suitable office space. And the visual effects team came in, and we locked down that sequence and then started immediately working on, I mean, a team of 10 people were like all huddled around and talking about the visual effects. Because when we cut it, it was just, you know, like empty. It was just a shot of like, you know, the camera whipping up into the air. And it's like, oh no, we're going to put a monster there and a monster here. And, you know, and then that team was able to go and then get to work because it was so intensive. There's going to be so much feedback that needed to happen too.
Yeah. Along those lines, there are a couple of visual effects shots with the creatures. It sounds like you flesh out the scene a little bit, but then do you go back and refine it once you see the intensity of what they give you with the creatures? Or
it's very much so.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. It's a constant. The Mist, there were three versions of that movie in theaters, depending on how far along we were in the process of the filmmaking and releasing prints. So there was, we still did film prints then, and we also did digital cinema releases. And there were two versions of the digital cinema release, I believe, and one version of the film. We were doing our film out, and we actually halted it in the middle of it because we made a change to like reel four. We like called the lab, and we're like, stop, we just made changes. So you're constantly making changes along the way as you start to get your visual effects in. We have an application that we can use, and you can use them anywhere. Like when we were on The Walking Dead, what we would do is we had our visual effects house was in Pasadena, and our cutting rooms were in different locations around LA, but you know, they were in Hollywood, let's say, for this at one point. And then our production crew was shooting in Atlanta. And then we have producers that are like maybe in New York. And what we can do is we can all get on the phone or on our iPads and load up this application and look at a visual effects shot. And we can play the shot back and forward, and we can draw on it. And we can all talk about how, you know, okay, here's how we want this shot to look, and here's where we want, you know, the blood to go, or this is where we want the city to be, or whatever the shot is that we're talking about. And we can all get on the phone and discuss it all at once, no matter where we are in the world.
This would be something like Frame.io or something similar?
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, there's like CineSync, and I think when we were on The Mist, it was called Cafe Sync. Our visual effects company was called Cafe FX. But yeah, I mean, they're all basic versions of the same thing. It's kind of like FaceTime, except for you're playing a shot, right? You're playing like a visual effect shot or a sequence back and forth, and then you can go through and discuss it shot by shot exactly how you want everything to lay out. And it's a great tool to get everybody onto the same page.
One of the things that's interesting about the Mist editorially is that you all have lots of groups of people and how they segment and the way that they interact. Was that a challenge of managing the eye lines and breaking them up cinematically?
Yes, it was.
That sounds like, yeah, that took us a few weeks to get that right.
Well, I mean, it was the biggest challenge, I think, was for production to go and cover all of these eye lines. But where the challenge was for me was that it was just a tremendous amount of footage. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was in order because you have so many different stories to tell. You have so many different characters to keep track of. We ended up with, I think it was like 110 hours of film.
Oh, wow.
On The Mist. And then, you know, it's 2 hours of screen time. So the shooting ratio was rather extreme in that one.
So for any of those shots, did you have to cheat or flip the shot to make the eye lines match? Or?
Oh, of course.
Yeah,
of course. Oh yeah, that's all in your big bag of tricks. Yeah, we're always doing stuff like that. I mean, there's one shot in there where Ollie has come out and he's like, "Everybody, be quiet! There's something going on. Everyone, gather around." He has everybody come and gather around, and he and David Drayton start to tell the story about like what's going on, that there's these things out there, and then you know we should be careful and we don't know what's happening, and people are like going, "That's impossible! You don't know what you're talking about." And there's this reaction on that we have that we really wanted. It's the perfect reaction to what's happening. But the guy right behind her was making a face that took away from the dramatic response that she had. And so we went and removed that face. We found another reaction and we popped that onto his head and put that behind her. I mean, there's as many small and large visual effects in The Mist as were in like the first Pirates of the Caribbean because of stuff like that. Not just the big key stuff that you expect, like, oh, there's a monster shot, but also just, you know, going through and just really fine detailing the storytelling that we're doing.
And would you do small amounts of that, or you send all of that to VFX?
In that case, all of that stuff went to visual effects. Because of where technology is now, a lot of that stuff we can do in the Avid so easily, and then it can get just carried on to the post house, and the post house can do some of that stuff now.
Right. So you might block it out, and then post effects could finesse it if need be.
Yes. No, we'll temp a lot of that stuff now. Almost all of that stuff we'll temp now in the Avid. Yeah.
And what about something like stabilization? I mean, there were a couple of Steadicam shots. Did they come out pretty smoothly, or were there times where you'd have to go in and try to stabilize it a little bit more to make it work in the shot?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I mean, when they, you know, that movie, when we shot it, we shot some of that stuff 35 and most of it 16. So we actually had, like, there was some extra headroom there. So a lot of the shots, we actually custom did the camera move because we had a lot of room outside of the viewable frame. So we were able to step out and go, okay, you know, we want the camera to like swing up here. We actually want to see more of the ceiling or more of the ground or whatever. And so we were able to like go in and actually build our camera moves that way. And that's a very, very, very common trick now.
And when you're doing that, are you scanning the film in at 4K or even larger?
In that case, yes. Now, though, you'll shoot like, you know, you'll shoot 4K images, but only use like, you know, but actually like frame for like 2K, and it gives you like tons more room on that you can move around. Like the digital image now is like so much more pliable, which is really, really cool. And we can go in and do a lot more now to like custom fit exactly what we want. I mean, there are some filmmakers that will go, and this is a little bit more experimental, but we'll go and shoot a very high resolution wide frame and then say, well, you know, we'll crop and build our close-ups as we go. And then it's certainly a trick that I have done and use, and I'm grateful for that freedom. But there's something to be said for using like the right lens for the right sized shot and going and capturing the image and the and also the filmmaker having the intention of this shot being a close-up and the intention of this shot being a wide shot. It just creates, I think, to me, it's just significantly better storytelling. So I don't think it should become a crutch as much as it should just be this amazingly cool tool that we have to help us better tell stories.
Something else that stuck out about the way the story unfolds in The Mist is the way that you have these contrasts of quiet moments and then explosive sound.
Oh yeah.
Around the time when the action kicks in. Is that something that that you wanted? Is that something that Frank gave you input on, or how'd that come about?
It's really great that you know that you mentioned that, because I'm a huge fan of sound and it being loud when it needs to be and being quiet when it needs to be. And there are moments when it actually goes in that movie where it actually goes dead quiet, like theater dead still. And I remember when we were working with the mixers, like they were like, what? You want to do what? And Frank was like, no, quiet, like nothing. Like I want no sound. And you would, and so they did it. And then he's like, no, there's still backgrounds there. Like we have to go like take it all out, go completely silent. And it's something that I've seen with Frank on so many different projects is, and myself included, is being like, what? That's crazy. You can't do that. And then as soon as you do it, you're like, oh my gosh, it's genius. and you just, this like light goes off and it just challenges you to become a better filmmaker. And one of the moments in The Mist that where we really did it effectively, I think, is the group has gone to the pharmacy to get the burn medication and supplies. And then we come back to the supermarket and we don't know if they're going to make it back. And the camera is going around to all of these extremely tense faces and it just falls dead silent. And then bang, the group bangs onto the glass doors. And it's such a great jump scare. It's such just a fun, like as a fan of horror, it's such a fun, scary moment. And it's exactly what you're talking about though, because then right after there becomes this cacophony of sound of all the people like quickly opening the door and like the screaming and the like, oh my gosh, are you guys okay? And this terrible thing just happened. So yes, that was very intentionally designed.
Well, I noticed something similar in the Walking Dead pilot. So let's talk about that one, another collaboration with you and Frank Darabont. And you do have that setup where it seems fairly quiet at first, and then you get the zombie and the loud action. So it does seem like you like working with contrast or
oh, very much so.
Something that Frank does as well. So talk about the thinking in managing contrast.
I mean, one of the things that I think that we get to do visually with contrast is you can come into a scene and start on an extreme close-up, which raises a question of where am I and what is this and who else is in the room? And then you can immediately pop out to a gigantic wide shot and explain that to people. Or you can choose to stay in tight. I mean, this is kind of the fun thing of editing is figuring out how do you give the information to the audience that they need, and when are you teasing them along in a good way where they're raising questions, and when are you, you know, being painful and you need to give it up now. And I think the moment in The Walking Dead that you're referencing is one of my favorite moments, which is when Rick is riding into Atlanta on the horse and there's no score, and Atlanta has been, you know, it's the post-apocalyptic Atlanta with burned out buses and tanks and helicopters and you know, just kind of destroyed city. But when they shot that, it's an active live city. I mean, Atlanta is a real active place. And so the sound that was rolling was just filled with like sirens and people and helicopters and airplanes and all this stuff. So what I did was I cut that with no sound, and that ended up creating this incredibly quiet place to start from, because we started from nothingness. And it's his entire write up. And I worked with one of the things that an assistant editor does that I value is they do a lot of sound work. And we had an assistant on that show named Nathan Gunn, and Sarah Minia were the two assistants on the pilot. They did tremendous amounts of work to build silence and tell the story of a man on a horse going. It's basically like a desert scene. It's basically a Western, but it's in the middle of the city. And all you hear is the horse's hooves on the pavement. And then when you go to the bus, you hear the bit of the metal ronking in the bus, and like one zombie gets up, but it's nothing scary. And we went through and literally built all of those sounds in the editing room. And it was a result of the sound in the city just being so loud that we just literally went to nothingness. And then that's where we built up from. And it stayed so quiet as a result. And then he comes around the corner and there's like a giant, you know, herd of zombies right there. And he has to run from them.
And then you got kick into high gear.
Yeah. And then the music comes in and then it all just explodes into sound.
Yeah. And that one is interesting because there's so much contrast. There's the sound contrast, like you said. There's also a nice balance between the rural landscape when he's on the horse in the grassy fields, and then the city, which is more frantic. And even emotionally, you have the action-packed moments balanced with the quiet moments. How did you try to balance some of those different dynamics?
Frank is just such a smart filmmaker, and I'm very, very fortunate to get to work with him. And one of the things when I looked back on As starting to get in the dailies, you're starting to look at it, is you realize that it's a very lonely story in the beginning. I mean, it's really just one man's story, one man's journey in the very beginning. But one of the things that we did in that I was so proud of, and I started to realize it when I was coming together. I mean, there's elements of it that are the Twilight Zone, like when Rick wakes up in the hospital and has no idea what's going on. It's like Stanley Kubrick's The Shining at times when he's walking through the hospital and it's just these Steadicam images that are following him. It's a Western. It's a man that goes and, you know, wearing a cowboy sheriff's hat and hops on a horse. And it's a George Romero zombie flick when the horse gets attacked and overrun by the zombies. And all of that kind of gets mushed into this. It's all part of the film language of that 1 hour of TV. And yeah, there's a lot happening there. And the thing that I think that Frank does so well is finding a tone that is true horror while also maintaining humanity. And that is, to me, the great gift of that pilot, is that it is truly horrific, but told from real emotion, real human emotion and real human character. And also just getting to pay homage to like all the great storytellers that have kind of come before us, which was just a blast for me. I said when I was getting the footage, this is just for me to mess up. it's all so good.
Yeah, you don't want to be that guy. I gave you all this. What did you do? What's happening?
Right. And you know, a little point of pride for me that I just love is we actually locked that episode in 3 days.
Ooh, that's impressive.
It was really fast. Now, juxtapose that with like when we went and we did Mob City Pilot. The Mob City Pilot took us like weeks to get through to find that one. Or even like The Mist. I mean, The Mist was just, we just kept working on that one. We worked on that one for like 6 months or so.
Right. So The Mist, you said you had like about over 100 hours.
Yeah, it was 110 hours, I believe. Yeah. The Walking Dead pilot was 21 hours.
All right. So a little bit more manageable as far as all that content.
Yeah. Which is funny because like Preacher finale, I had 21 hours for one scene.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah. I remember when that footage started coming in, my assistant and I were like, oh my goodness, how are we ever going to finish this?
On a TV show, schedules are a little tighter. Do you have editing options, or it's just like, here's pretty much the shots that you're going to use for this scene?
Well, I mean, the director will go out and shoot the scenes, I mean, for sure. But one of the things that's really great about all of this is, you know, I can call up set and say, hey guys, like, I really need this moment. Like, we missed this moment. We should get that. Or I can slug for it in my Avid and just say, hey, we need to go get a shot of this. And that happens all the time. I remember on The Walking Dead season 3, there was this moment where the guys go in and they find someone in a shed. And I was like, you know what we need? What would be great is if we had a Steadicam shot, you know, pushing in on this mound on the bed, and then like, and then Rick's hand entered frame, and then, you know, they pulled it back, and then they went and I called the director and, you know, or shot him an email or something, and then they went and they shot it. So it's definitely a give and a take. It's certainly the director's responsibility to go and shoot the scene.
They'll still give you standard coverage, like here's establishing wide, close up, so you have some options.
Sure, but then there is a collaboration. You know, like a lot of times they will call and check in and say, hey, are we, you know, what do I need? Am I getting everything I need? Like, what else should I be getting? So there's certainly like a give and take and a communication back and forth between the cutting room and set.
On the pilot of Walking Dead, you have that conversation with the two main characters right after the title sequence. And a lot of that is done in close-up. Mm-hmm. And it seems like you are inclined to use the close-up. Some people are, I think, a little more hesitant to use it, but it seems like you're open to using it even back and forth. So talk a little bit about your sensibilities in regards to the close-up.
Well, I love the close-up. I love the close-up a little too much. I need
to. No, it's not bad. It was an interesting way to set those guys up.
Oh, no, it's true, though. No, it's totally true. I'm aware of my weakness. So that I do have a weakness for the close-up. I love a good close-up because you're telling the story of these people. I want to see their eyes and I want to see how they're reacting, you know? But sometimes when you're editing, like also like there's something to body language and how are the people reacting to each other? I need to cut out to like a looser, you know, loose cowboy or something, or out to a wide shot where you see how they're interacting in the space together. That scene, an interesting thing though, to be specific about that scene was actually the scene you're talking about is the two guys are sitting in the sheriff's police car. And then they get a call that these guys have like robbed a bank or something. I forget exactly what the call was, but there's these two guys that they need to go deal with, and they go and they set up the tire thing and they have the shootout. They were shooting that in the summer in Atlanta, and they were supposed to shoot that in this downtown area in like an actual like downtown Main Street square. But it was so hot and humid. They were like, we can't do this. We have to shoot this on a soundstage. We have to get out of the heat. So they actually shot that indoors with a backdrop of the town that they were going to shoot it in. So one of the reasons why that shot in close-up is because they're just on a soundstage.
Ah, right. It's just like, otherwise you see the crew and the lights. And
yeah, and there's like a fan running that like blows. There's like a bush that like, you know, moves occasionally. And then we cut out to the location, which is the big wide shot. And again, there's another juxtaposition of sizes, right? So we're in tight close-ups for the whole conversation until the radio call comes in. And when the radio call comes in, we pop out to a big wide shot as the car drives away. But yeah, I mean, I do adore a good, a good meaty close up. a nice 50 mil lens featuring the mug of one of our actors.
The Walking Dead was also the show that got you your Eddie. So you get recognition from your peers. Do you want to talk briefly about that?
Yeah, I mean, winning the Eddie was a huge thing for me. It was a big honor. I'm actually very proud of it. American Cinema Editors is a group of people that honor peers, like you said, of editorial peers that honor the best editing for that year. It's part of the big award season stuff. And for me, it was particularly cool and special because I'd been to the Eddies twice. I went to the Eddies as an intern, and then 10 years later exactly, I went to the Eddies and won the award.
There you go. It's a nice sense of progress, right? Moving up in the world. All right. Going from intern to award.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I think I was the first intern to win an Eddie. So it was pretty special. Yeah, it was really a big honor. And I was I had to get up and give a speech, which, as I discussed earlier, I absolutely hate doing. And I was a big wreck. And all I wanted to do was get up and say thank you and then run away. and I pretty much did that. That's pretty much what happened. But no, it was very, very special.
I want to take a quick break from our interview with Hunter to share a special message with you. I am so grateful to you for supporting the show, for helping it grow and become what it is. Thank you so much. I am planning the episodes coming up for next year. So if there's something of interest that you want to hear, let me know. I'm here for you. So shoot me an email. It's podcast@ncivitis.com. Share your story ideas or the things that you like about the show, things you want to hear more of. It's not too late to possibly get a shot at being on the show yourself. In fact, this very section, just take a moment, tell me what it is you like about the show, if you have a favorite episode and why, and possibly you could be on this part talking about that, but also telling us a little bit about what you do. The email for that, once again, podcast@ncivitis.com. All right, now let's get back to our interview with Hunter Vai. Let's talk about a different show, Sons of Anarchy. I understand that you recut the pilot for that. So how does that work? I mean, you got notes from the studio or the showrunners basically saying, here's what we need kind of thing?
Yeah. So recuts are a special beast, and I actually really, really enjoy them. In fact, in the Sons of Anarchy pilot was the first, I think it was the first time I did a recut. So what happened with that was I knew Kurt Sutter from The Shield, and I knew some of the producers from The Shield, and I was actually living in Atlanta wrapping up a movie, and I had left Los Angeles. I lived in LA for 7 years and left. And was wrapping up a movie in Atlanta, and I get a call from my friend Craig Yehata, one of the producers, and he says, I know this is a long shot, but, you know, can you be out in LA in 2 weeks to recut the Sons pilot? And my wife was very pregnant at the time, and I said to her, hey, this came in. I know the answer is no, but I just wanted you to know. And she's like, let's give it a shot.
what a supportive wife.
I couldn't believe it. Yeah. So we packed up and drove cross country again. And this was the end of the cross country trips. After this, we were done. And we moved out to LA. What happened was, is on the Sons pilot is they actually recast one of the lead actors, Ron Perlman, was actually not originally in the original cast. And then they shuffled around some of the guys that were in the club and moved them into different roles. And part of what I was tasked with was obviously going in and working with this new director, Michael Denner, to get in the new material and the new stuff that was written, but also just to kind of give it a little bit more energy and just kind of take a different look at it once we got in all the new material. So Sidney Walensky, a very fantastic editor, cut the first one with his directing team, and you know, they did obviously great work because it got picked up. I was brought in to kind of finish what they had started and to craft it into what ended up becoming the style of the show.
Elaborate on the style and how you feel that serves the story, because it is a different editing feel than, say, The Walking Dead.
You know, it's funny because in a way I actually see similarities between
them. Oh, okay. Interesting.
They both come from a point of view of now, I mean, certainly The Walking Dead is a genre thing. So it is separate there, but and in a way Sons is genre too. Cause it is a bit pulpy, but both of them approach their editing from a point of view of less is more. As far as let the camera work do it for you, and keep it character focused. If you're going to do jump cuts and that kind of stuff, always done to serve the character, not done to just move a story along and to be flashy. So in that regard, I think they're actually very similar. And FX and AMC both, I think, look for, you know, elevated, mature storytelling that tends to be violent. At least in those cases.
Well, speaking of the violence, what suggestions do you have to other filmmakers or editors about putting together a compelling fight sequence, a gun sequence, let's say?
I really, really believe very strongly in always tell the story of the character and follow the character. I get very upset when I watch action sequences that are extraordinarily exciting on the surface, but then you realize you don't know who you're rooting for or why. And I feel like a lot of modern action sequences are cut viscerally, but they are forgetting to tell the story of the character and our hero and who we're rooting for and why are they making the decisions that they're making and why do they choose to do what they do? And then we see it. We see the reaction of what they've done, and then we see the outcome of what they've done versus it just being a bunch of quick cuts of people punching and shooting and explosions. Actually being and living with our characters and understanding the decision making is really important to me.
So give an example of how you all did that in Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah, that's funny. I'm trying to go through and think. Let me give you a better example.
Okay.
So The Walking Dead season 3, we have a massive, massive action sequence. And it's when the governor gets this truck and fills it with zombies and drives it through the gates of the prison, and the zombies come spilling out. And our heroes are spread all about in different areas, and this huge gun battle takes place. And then the governor goes up on a hill and he starts shooting, and he shoots at Michonne, and Rick is like pinned down in a field, and Herschel gets trapped in a field, and Glenn has to go and save him, and always during all of that, you want to keep it exciting and action-packed. But none of it matters if you don't see that Rick, the hero, is helpless, trapped in the grass, unable to do anything on the other side of this fence. And that despair and that helplessness is the emotional core that tells the story. Meanwhile, you have wonderful action happening and Herschel almost dying and Glenn coming in and running over a bunch of zombies and Michonne chopping them up and, you know, and the governor like shooting but always keeping at a core who your heroes are and how they are reacting to what's happening. You know, it's John McClane in Die Hard pulling glass out of his foot.
Right. That helps to center it. That brings you back to his perspective.
Right. 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 And it humanizes it, too. And it keeps it a real character story.
All right. Just to take a quick break from the interview to let you know, this is where we start talking about Preacher season 1 finale. And we go into a bit of the story of that episode. If you don't want to know what happens at that part of the series, pause the episode, come back and listen after you've had a chance to watch. All right. You've been warned. Onward. Another one of the things you've done that you said that you were quite proud of is Preacher season finale. So tell me a little bit about that. What are you proud of about the work there?
Well, I mean, you know, we had people have conversation with God.
Yeah, there's that.
Preacher is, for me, a wonderful challenge because it was so, it's a core example of what we're talking about with the characters. It's keeping the characters center frame at all times while all of this absolute insanity takes place. And for me, balancing the comedy with the drama, with the horror, with the mystery, and it's all of these things, kind of this crazy thing bundled up into one. And the finale really encapsulated all of that. You know, Jesse goes on this quest to, you know, he has this power, and he's trying to figure out what's going on and where it comes from, and is finally like, you know what, I'm gonna call God down here and ask him what's going on through this God phone, and uses a severed angel hand to to do it, and it's so crazy and over the top, but it also needs to be taking their story very seriously. And when God comes down, like, I put it together, I'm like, I believe that they are talking to God. And I know they're not. I know they're talking to, you know, a television screen that's like been put up on a monitor stand with a man dressed in a white robe. And, you know, like I said, that was 21 hours, just that scene, and of footage to come together. And, you know, simply from pragmatic level of just being able to like wade through all of that and tell something that was coherent. But also, I'm very proud of it because it was very difficult tightrope to walk there to tell that story, and to do it in a way that isn't condescending to anyone, and most of all our audience, but also to our characters. Because if it became too silly, then it wasn't taking their journey and their quest seriously. But it is kind of silly.
Yeah, I mean, you all did have a couple different tones in that. I mean, I was almost thinking, oh, we're going to go Monty Python with some of that when they had the screen of the figure who is supposed to be God up there. But you all did navigate that. You all gave different perspectives to the people in the audience. You saw some of their different reactions.
I mean, very much so. Like it dives straight into Monty Python. I mean, it really did. Like it went straight into Monty Python at first, and then it becomes something much more serious and much darker, and that leads us into this montage that is one of the darkest, saddest, most depraved things I've ever worked on, and I've worked on some really dark stuff.
Yeah, this was one that I can acknowledge the technical achievement of it, but the overall feel of it, I did not like it, right? I mean, I was trying to give Preacher a shot, but man, that was just so bleak. So I'll give you a shot. You can try to sell it to me. What am I missing? Why should I appreciate it more than I do?
Okay, so do you mean that one episode, or did you watch the whole series?
I haven't watched the whole series. I watched bits of I saw the beginning few episodes, and there were interesting things going on there. But then the finale was so bleak.
Well, the math adds. Okay, so this is a town that's damned.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, Anvil it's filled with terribly flawed people. Some of them certainly do not deserve what they got. That's just true. It's very sad for some of them because they're all dead. I mean, what I adore about storytelling and filmmaking and stuff personally is the fantastical, is kind of the magical element of things. And Preacher is not real. Preacher is fantastical. And is not, in my opinion, to be taken literally. It should be taken much more symbolically. And the fact that it is such a unique thing, and it is not for everyone. It is truly not for everyone. But it is just such a unique story that we get to tell, that alone, I think, gives it a lot of merit. Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg are the producers on it, that they have been on for a long time. And Sam Catlin is our showrunner. And the unbelievable amount of care that they have for the characters and the story that's being told, and for it to be done truthfully through them, it's really remarkable. It's really remarkable. And, you know, certainly from a technical achievement, I think some of the people that we have on that show are just the best at what they do. But the story is so unique. I've never seen anything like it anywhere else.
Yeah. I can acknowledge the technical achievement without recommending it necessarily. I mean, it's not, certainly not in keeping with my sensibilities. I will say something like The Mist is a little bleak too, but it's sort of right at my threshold. The ending for that was a little tough to take, but like, okay, I liked the story, the novella, I believe, that Stephen King wrote.
Well, it ends on hope. I mean, it literally ends on hope. I mean, that's, yeah.
you mean the novella in contrast, yes, to the film? Yeah, it's a little different. So it's a little bleaker in the film.
Significantly bleaker.
But yeah, I would say Preacher is way beyond my threshold of bleakness, and at least the finale.
Yeah, the finale is exceptionally bleak.
Yeah.
In that moment, in that montage. I mean, when I was doing it, I was like, when I was putting that together, I was like, this is the, like, I feel sad. Like, I've never felt so sad.
Well, you certainly achieved that. I mean, it was like, I feel so sad and I do not wish to revisit this again.
Well, that montage originally had Willie Nelson Somewhere Over the Rainbow in it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is phenomenal because we have Dorothy in it. Like, it was just so perfect. But the author of Somewhere Over the Rainbow would not give us the right to use it.
Because probably he's like, that, I don't know, is the most ideal way that I want my song associated.
Yeah, I mean, Willie Nelson was fine with it. It was Willie Nelson Somewhere Over the Rainbow. It was perfect. Yeah. It was fantastic. And it gave it that slightly less darkness versus Blind Melon's song that ended up in there, which that ended up still giving it a touch of the lightness, but it was still just a little too dark for what was there, versus Somewhere Over the Rainbow, which is a little bit, you know, it's a little cheeky.
So you're saying that might have softened it a little bit.
I think, well, I don't know if it softened it. It also made him way more tragic in a way.
A little more Willie Nelson poetic. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It was still tragic, but maybe a little bit less.
Would you say the show is open to religion or kind of anti-religion?
Yeah. No, I don't think so. No, I think it's definitely open. I think that's very much it.
I felt that for some of the other ones, it was like, okay, there's at least some earnestness to the characters at some times, right? Like, I didn't feel like they were making fun of the characters.
No, not at all. Not at all. And not making fun of religion at all. No, I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I think there's this mystery, like God is missing, and then you have to go figure out why. I mean, and Jesse says in the finale, he's like, look, if he needs our help, we'll help him. But if he doesn't, then we're going to set it straight. Like, he needs to get back up there and be God.
Okay. All right.
My interpretation is that it is not anti-religion at all.
It's open to it and doing some really stylized violence kind of stuff to go along with the metaphysical search.
Yes. Yes. I mean, and it's, you know, it's a comic book from the 90s. It's what it's based off of. And if you read the comic book,
I was going to say, I mean, I remember reading some of the comic books as well. And yeah, I mean, there's some extreme elements in that as well.
I mean, it's wonderfully profane.
Or troublingly, like, it's gleefully profane, right? Depending on your perspective.
Yes. Yes, that's true. I mean, the reason why I would say wonderfully or gleefully is that it revels in it. A comic book, I don't think, is attempting to offend as much as simply being.
Yeah, I see.
Do you know what I mean?
I do. I'm not sure.
A difference in like torture porn and like torture porn to me is like intentionally lacking in some type of social narrative, where like the horror that I like The Mist, if you look at it, there's something being said. There's a political statement. There's an anger at the way that the world is, like, which is funny because, you know, the divisiveness that that movie was trying to address then has only grown and become much worse. And the message of The Mist is actually way more on point now than it was then. So, like, where I feel like Preacher, it is profane, it is offensive, it is all of those things, but it's not doing it to be offensive. That's my take, at least.
Yeah. Well, I'll consider. I'm not sure I would agree, but
I'm not winning you over.
So it seems like you are drawn to these post-apocalyptic stories that are sometimes bleak. So what do you see the value in telling bleak stories to people? Can that have any kind of value beyond the story?
Sure. I mean, yes. I mean, but to me, though, there's always, like, my favorite type of story or horror film is when you take a group of people and something terrible happens, right? I don't mean something terrible happens and, like, they all die. I just mean, like it's like, oh, my gosh, like, this terrible thing is happening. How are we going to survive? And that, to me, is the story that I find to be the most compelling, is the human survival. You know, the story of how they work together as a team, how they come together to overcome something that is bigger than them. And it's the same type of story of, like, if you were to look at, like, it's, you know, it's a David versus Goliath type story. And whether it's being done in, like, a business where, like, you know, someone's trying to take on Walmart, I just find that same story to be much more compelling when it's, you know, Frankenstein or when Dr. Goliath Frankenstein's wins, monster.
Goliath no. wins and kills all of the villagers no. who fought against him.
No. It's the other story. It's when they do overcome. You know, it's when they do get beaten down, but they do overcome.
Okay, so you're basically likening the season finale of Preacher to David and Goliath. It's essentially the little guy triumphs.
No, I don't know about that.
Are they triumphing against God? Is that what it is?
No. I just thought you were asking. I thought you were asking more broadly, not specifically to Preacher.
No, I was. I'm just giving you a little bit of a hard time. But yeah, I guess it is. I mean, you could say that these are difficult times we're facing, and stories that are darker or bleaker can reflect in some way the struggles that people feel trying to survive today.
Well, I mean, I think always there's that. I mean, that's what makes for great, like, sci-fi, right? I mean, like, that's what makes for great sci-fi, great horror, great storytelling of any kind, is it functions on one level as an entertaining and compelling story, you know, whether it's two people falling in love, but then you take it and it's two people falling in love, you know, in Virginia, and they're trying to overcome the fact that they're not legally allowed to get married because they're mixed race, right? And then you now have a movie that works on multiple levels. And whether you take that and you apply it to, like, horror, or you apply it to poetry, whatever it is, like, something to me, that's when it's exciting, when it's elevated and it's more than that. And also the idea of it being survival and hope and things like that are what I prefer to have be in there. Like, The Mist is certainly a very, very dark ending. Very, very dark ending. And I now have an 8-year-old boy. When I made the movie, I did not. And it's much more difficult. And I remember we screened it for somebody and they came out of it and they had, I think they, at the time, they had like a 2 or 3-year-old son. And this man came out and he was crying. And he's like, I can't talk to you right now about this ending. I need to go think about it. Like, it means too much to me. So I certainly acknowledge the fact that, like, these very, very bleak endings, I am drawn to it. I had an assistant at one point that said to me, Hunter, when are we going to go make the Puppy Dogs and Rainbow show? Because I do tend, it's funny because I'm not in any way, like, I am an extraordinarily passive individual, but I do tend to work on these shows where violence sometimes is the answer. Right? That's kind of weird. It seems that way, at least.
Are you a pretty happy-go-lucky guy during the week? And it's just like, this is that you need something. See, it's almost like I'm the other side of that, right? I mean, during the week, it's sometimes difficult for me to take positive, hopeful steps forward. Even each day, it's like, okay, what can I do today that's one small, positive, hopeful step forward? And I don't always get there. Sometimes I succeed. Other days, it's just going through the routine, right? So when I see something that is just over-the-top bleakness, it's like, man, why do I even Why do I even bother? You know?
But see, okay, I think then, like, Preacher, I think if you had watched the whole season, you would see it a little bit differently.
Okay, fair enough.
Because most of the bad stuff that happened to those people, especially during that montage, were people that kind of deserved what they got. You know, the kids on the school bus that killed the guy, like, he had attempted to molest those girls earlier in the season. And a lot of these people had done bad things or were terribly flawed people. Or you could say they weren't, and some of them, you know, that's, to me, is what's interesting, is that it's not necessarily black and white. I completely agree that I believe that most things are gray. You know, people aren't truly good and truly evil, or actions. There's, you know, looking at the world as things that are like black and white, I think, oversimplifies things. And that is one of the things that I think that these darker, you know, edgier, whatever tales allow you to deal with, is that life isn't black and white. Things aren't that simple.
Yeah, I mean, the shades of gray and the character moments were interesting in Preacher, right? Those things I connected to. It was just the overwhelming amount of... It's almost like you said, you know, like the ending for Mist wasn't bleak enough. But anyway, on a different note, is there another special collaborative moment for any of your projects that sticks out?
My favorite part of being an editor is that we get to be in our rooms by ourselves doing stuff. And then, you know, you get to work with your directors and producers and kind of go through the whole thing. And in the end, after we've done color and after we've done the visual effects and everything's kind of come together in a perfect world, that's how it goes. You're on a dub stage doing the sound, and you're working with the music from the composers and the sound effects, and you're working with all this stuff, and you get to sit back and actually look at all of the work that you've done. And as an editor, I know every edit and the stories and the decisions behind the things and the stories that happen on set. And you can kind of, like, there's a moment of reflection where you kind of get to do this, and you're working with this team of people whose job it is solely to find, like, the right footfall on gravel, or are the right, you know, bird chirping in the distance. It's these things that, like, as an audience member, you really don't think much about. There's something called Foley, which is, you know, like the, you know, people, it's people's movements, like people walking or grabbing chairs or falling down or whatever. Usually the Foley is mixed a little too loud. It's too forward. Like, I don't want to focus on the footfall. I want to focus on the character's face. I don't want to focus on the fact that they're wearing a boot.
Right. So minimize it a little bit, keep it in the background.
Right. So we're doing this, we're on the dub stage, and this is, and I'm like, my goodness, this is the best Foley I've ever heard. This is so great. And they're like, oh, you are, because there's a person who goes and records this stuff. It's not just sound effects. Like, some of it is sound effects, but there's a person whose job it is they're a Foley artist. And there's a room, and they go, you should go and tell this guy that you think his work is so great. Nobody ever goes over there. So I go over there, and there's this recording room filled with, like, chairs and leather gloves and shoes and high heels and different platforms to walk on, like grass and gravel and concrete. And there's a man in a giant bathtub wearing a wetsuit rolling around in it. And there's no picture because they stopped it when I came in. He was being the panda from Kung Fu Panda. It's splashing around in water.
Ah.
And so I go over there and I meet him and I talk to him. He's a really awesome guy. And turns out he's the guy that recorded the whip for Indiana Jones.
Oh, wow. What's his name?
I don't know. I should look it up and know his name. I feel terrible that I don't know his name. I came to this interview unprepared.
Oh, it's all right. But it's another interesting meet story that you have, where you meet these intriguing people in bathroom-like environments, huh?
Yes. Well, and he ended up being the Foley artist on, I think it was Shawshank. It was Shawshank or Green Mile? Maybe it was Green Mile. Okay. So I told him that, you know, I was working on this thing with Frank, and he was like, oh my gosh, I want to come over. And he had gone to location and recorded sounds doing stuff on location, and had met Frank when they made the movie. And the two of them came back and hung out on the soundstage and told, like, old war stories from when they used to work together. It was just one of those moments. It was really cool. It was a really cool moment when you realize that, like, all of us in the filmmaking is such a collaborative thing. And there's people like me in dark rooms, and there's people like this guy in, like, a giant bathtub, and we're like, we're like all working together to make the project the best that we can. It was really cool. It was a little bit like going to Oz and having the curtain pulled back.
Right. Yeah. And
even for me, who's been doing it for so long, you know,
it was nice of you to give that guy his little compliment when he's like, no one ever, it's so beautiful, man. No one ever. And this was for which project where you really admired the Foley work?
That was on Mob City.
Mob City. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Hunter, last question for you. Let's say your ideal collaborator is listening to the show. What would you want him or her to know about getting the best out of you?
Oh, wow. I don't know. I think it'd be the same thing that I told my parents when I was like in high school. Negative feedback doesn't help me.
Stop yelling at me, Mom.
Yeah.
I'm going to make my bed, all right? Just give me a break.
Positive feedback is the best.
Yeah.
There are certainly people out there who are like yellers and shouters, and that's not a healthy work environment for me. I know some people that love it and think that that's how it's supposed to be. I don't.
Yeah, me neither. And I think people can get things done without that pressure. It's just sometimes people feel like it's easier to go that route, go more volume, more energy. And
yeah.
Good. Well, people want to learn more about what you do. Is there a site they can go to? I mean, there's your IMDb page, right?
I'll say yes, there's my IMDb page, but do you mean to actually get in touch with me if they want to?
If you have anything like that, if not, that's fine.
Facebook. I use Facebook for that all the time. In fact, I was just talking to someone last night about, she was young, wanting to become an editor and was talking to her about it. So I always do that. Yeah. So please, Facebook, Hunter, it's just Hunter Vine.
All right. Great. Well, Hunter, thank you so much for joining us, and best of wishes to you on your ongoing projects.
Thanks, man. I had a great time.
Yeah. And that's my interview with Hunter Vai. Now, this is the part of the show where I talk a little bit about some of the things that came up in the episode. Really glad that I got to talk to Hunter. Really engaging guy. Lots of fun stories that he had to share with us. And it was also encouraging to hear about the way that he likes to support his assistant editors. Having that apprentice-like program is something that's faded away in a lot of the industry, but there's still people out there like Hunter that try to do that, to pay it forward. I was also amused about his story regarding the Foley artist, how he took the time to appreciate him in the bathtub of all places. But hey, you know, you meet people where you can. If you are interested in learning more about the work that a Foley artist does, check out the episode I did with a Foley artist from Despicable Me. He helped create the sounds for the Minions and some other projects. So I'll include that in the show notes. You can give that a listen if you're curious. It was also great to hear about the decision-making process that goes into an edit for some of these films or TV shows. Editing is one of the big ways that you shape a story, and we hear from the directors of a project, sometimes even the writers, but not always the editors, and I think they bring a unique perspective on the storytelling process. Of all the projects that we discussed, the one that I would most recommend would be the Walking Dead pilot. You've probably seen it, but it's a really great work of editing and filmmaking. There's a lot of variation. There's contrast and affinity in all kinds of ways. And then there is the Preacher season finale. As you heard in the episode, I was conflicted about it, to say the least. Now, I should mention that I did the interview shortly after watching that finale, just a day or two after, in fact, and it was an episode that was still weighing on me, and it was something that hurt a little bit, let's say. It was unsettling and bleak, and I had a visceral reaction to it, and that carried over into the interview. With a little bit more time, has my perspective on it changed? Well, it's complicated. I got to give a show like Preacher credit for asking the big questions. And I did see some of the series prior to the finale, and I was torn because they're doing things like having these really bloody fights in church where at times it felt like, all right, they're just doing this because it's like, hey, here's what we can get away with. But then I would see something that was really earnest. Dominic Cooper's performance, in particular, the guy who plays Preacher, is Ernest. And you have this setup of someone who is very conflicted, a troubled past, clearly. And yet he's trying to do the best he can. He's trying to do good. And that is interesting to me. And the, it seems like that's a preoccupation of the show. Can people who are flawed in so many ways and caught up in whatever it is they are caught up in, whether their particular sexual hangups or alcohol or a violent past, can they have these things in their lives and still try to be decent people, even when they can't always see God clearly? All right, that's interesting. And they're asking the big questions. Where is God? Why can't we see him? I respond to that kind of storytelling, and I appreciate it when storytellers do try to tackle these difficult topics. The notion of God being absent, being missing, is one that has come up elsewhere. I mean, Philip Pullman did it in his Dark Materials trilogy. In both the Philip Pullman books and the Preacher finale, there's the implication that possibly God is slacking on the job, that he's gone missing because he can't really handle all the chaos, the madness, whatever it is, or he just doesn't care. There's that possibility. Another possibility is that God might still be there. It's just gotten harder for us to see him. Maybe we've grown uglier. Maybe we've lost sight of him, forgotten how to see the divine. How could that be? Well, I mean, look at our entertainment, filled with all kinds of profanity, people blowing each other up, blood everywhere. We're supposedly made in the image of God. You got to wonder, what is it about us that drives us to, like, yeah, more blood, I want blood, blow it up. And then we have this culture where we're obsessed with sex. It's everywhere. You read a terrible news story, and at the very bottom, there's a link of some kind of clickbait that's near pornographic. The subtext for that is sort of like, hey, the world is so terrible and horrible. Don't you just want to look at something seductive and near pornographic? Like, oh, well, I wasn't thinking about it, but yeah, I guess maybe it is pretty lame, terrible. Okay. I mean, can you imagine if they put little vials of cocaine by some of these stories? Like, yeah, you read this story. The world is terrible. Don't you just want to do a line? Yeah, come on. Don't you? Don't you? And then we ask each other, where is God? I can't see him. I don't know why I can't see him. What's going on? Well, whatever it takes to get those page views, right? And then you have the Kardashians and all their ilk. And you have decent, hardworking people who see it and they're like, how could a loving God let these people thrive? But someone's clicking. It's like, you got to find out what are they doing now? And with so few clothes, don't you just want to see, don't you? People doing anything to get more attention. And why can't we see God? I don't know. But, you know, I will say the season finale did anticipate something in particular. It was prescient, even. What am I talking about? Well, let me try to illustrate with a, shall we say, theoretical example here, okay? Dear Lord Government, why do you think I enjoyed it? Well, just a little bit, but it was all for your glory. It was all for you. I made so many sacrifices on your behalf. Did you not hear all the slanderous things I said about those who disagreed with me, with you, and your benevolence and your destined kingdom, your promised salvation? I even had a sanctimonious hashtag about how loving we were, but then you didn't win, and it upset me. It made me angry, and then I said I'd work as caring, loving, but I had to go and damage property and punch some police officers. Where were you? Yeah. Maybe you have some idea of what I'm talking about. Maybe you don't. Look, this isn't a political show. I'm not going to go into it extensively. But we were talking about Stephen King earlier. Stephen King has been rather outspoken about his political thoughts. He does not like President Trump. That much is clear. But even earlier, before Trump was the front runner, he said this on Twitter: Cruz, Paul, and Rubio all running for president. Hey, I thought I was supposed to write the horror stories. Oh yeah, spooky, spooky stuff. They're running. Wait, what's spooky about them running? Except for, I mean, I guess they disagree with Stephen King on some things. And they're not under a criminal investigation. And I guess that's kind of freaky these days. It's interesting about Stephen King. He's got this ongoing thing that, the Republicans are voting for the Antichrist, Damien from The Omen. Ooh, spooky. Here's something else that's kind of spooky. Stephen King's son, Joe Hill, wrote Horns, which, if you read the Wikipedia description about it, suggests that it's a persuasive ode to sympathy for the devil. I've read the book, and I'm inclined to agree. So, taking father and son together, you have philosophical sympathy for the devil from the son. Dad says a certain candidate is the devil. Maybe father and son convinced a certain group of people to vote a certain way, not out of spite, not because they were tired of all the Republican jokes, but because they agreed, because they said, yes, I have sympathy for the devil, and I'm going to vote for him. The King family convinced me because they're great writers, and gosh darn it, I like them. And I say this as someone who appreciates their talents. They're very talented guys. Very good. Well, good. Talented. Good, a loaded word here, but yeah. Talented writers. Well, you can laugh at my logic if you want and call me a crazy conspiracy person. But it's not any more crazy than some of the ideas, some of the broad statements that have come out about pretty much half the country. Generalizations about the other side. Oh, well, they're not like us. They're obviously racist. Okay. Are there fringe elements in the Republican Party that are racist and bigoted? Sure, seems that way. Could we say the same about the Democrats? Yeah, I think so. Or people prone to anarchy or killing cops or hating whitey or whatever. We're not going to generalize and say that all of them are that way, right? Because that would be kind of crazy and conspiracy theory-like. Now, just to give you some context, I'm not saying these things as a Trump guy or a Hillary guy. I was wary of both of them. And like many Americans, I have some reservations about what will happen next. But it does seem like many of the things that Trump said were provocative things he said to get attention. Kind of like some of the things that other celebrities say and do. In fact, I would say some of the things that certain popular writers have written are even more troubling than the things that Trump has said, taken in isolation, as sometimes happens in these things. But, hey, it's tough to get people's attention these days and, you know, bills to pay, kids to feed and all that. Anyway, what were we saying? Not getting into politics. Right. I want to be hopeful about humanity, about our potential. But then there are things we do, each of us, myself included, that makes it hard to maintain that hope. Maybe there is some value in telling bleak stories to get us a better sense of what reality is really like, to help prepare us for all the insane things that we can do to each other. With both the protesters who turned violent right after an election, or the sports fans who do likewise when their team loses. Part of that is hope deferred. They both hoped and believed in something almost messianic. This thing is coming that we put our faith in, and it's going to happen, and it's going to make all the difference. When it doesn't, people react badly, and there's the inclination towards violence. And that's what the season finale of Preacher was exploring. So maybe there's some truth to it. Look, it's not raisin in the sun. If you want a thoughtful work of art about hope deferred and how it makes the heart sick, as the Proverbs say, go watch that play, A Raisin in the Sun. It's an exceptional play. But a certain tenant of humanity does seem to respond in keeping with what you see in Preacher. And I will say it hurts. It really hurts to expect something, to have a big hope and to see it fall apart. And it hurts even more when it's tied to grand cosmic significance, whether it's something like the government that some people place all their faith in. Oh, the government will save us. More government. That's the answer. Or God, or some other form of salvation. When you have that and it doesn't come through, it really hurts. And we see that even in the scriptures, even in the Bible. People talk about the Bible like, oh, it's all full of God. And God's there, but there's also times when people don't see him, when they're hurting and trying to figure out why they can't. The chosen people, supposedly God's favorite people, they get captured. They end up in Babylon for hundreds of years. They get enslaved. They end up wandering the wilderness, and they're wondering, where are you, God? Job, he says, hey, I did everything right. I was a good guy, and still I face these horrible things. And then the answer is there. It's a challenging book. The answer seems to be something like, well, hey, Job, you're not God. You don't understand everything. You don't know the big picture. You don't know what it takes to make this world work and to make things happen. Your suffering, maybe not just for you, maybe is there for others to see and be encouraged by, whether it's your friends or the other people around you, or the people who will hear this story for hundreds of years later. Maybe part of the things that you face is for them. All right. But still kind of hard to hear. I mean, there have been times when I have gone to church and it felt like God was so far away, even from this church, wherever I happen to be. And when that happens, my initial inclination is to say, look at these people. They're just like everyone else. They're just as status-minded, just as power-minded, just as hypocritical as people outside of church. Or look at this pastor. He's just as concerned, or even more concerned, in looking cool, in being accepted, just like everyone else. Right? Because people are flawed. And when we're hurting, it's easy to look to others. That's the problem. But maybe that's not the issue, right? Maybe the issue is with us, with me. Because if that's the case, then I have to start wondering, what am I doing that makes it hard for me to see God? Are the things in my life that maybe are a factor? Well, possibly. I'm not going around beating people up, but I have my vices. I have my angers. I have ways that I mistreat others, especially if I feel like I've been slighted. Maybe there's something in me. Maybe it's hard for me to see because of something I'm doing or something in my world. Now, at the heart of this discussion, and even a show like Preacher, there are two questions. Is there a God? And if so, is this God good? And how can that be given what we see? Right? And these are tough questions. But the aspect of goodness is important, because it could just be that there is a powerful being, an all-powerful being, but very much like us, or maybe even more corrupted and maniacal than we are. that's essentially Greek mythology for you, right? All powerful beings out there. There are primal forces. There must be something out there, but it's kind of like us, Zeus. He cheats, sleeps around, has these power struggles, overthrows his dad so that he can rule. I'm going to take over and bring my people against yours, right? Like, in that case, maybe we should look to the celebrities, right? Oh, these all-powerful entities. We will worship them. Or the government. We will worship them. Or maybe there's something bigger. Maybe there is something out there that is a kind of goodness beyond us. Okay, but then why are things the way they are? Why so much ugliness and tragedy that we can see? In Preacher, I think they try to explore that with the Indian thread. You see some of these Indians being killed. There's a sense of genocide. But if there is such a thing as good, then it stands to reason that there's also something that's the not good, the resistance to that good, evil, either in the universe out there or in us. When we put the emphasis on the evil done out there by them, that way we don't have to look at ourselves and say, what is it that we do that makes goodness stay so far away? Is there something that we do that might inhibit it? That's uncomfortable. Let's talk about something else. But, you know, good and evil, these are big, weighty notions. And so sometimes we want to have this sense of polarity, right? It's either good or evil, either or. But as Hunter was saying, sometimes there's value in exploring the shades of gray. Let's say there is goodness for now, and that it's sort of like light, as it's sometimes compared in various religious texts. All right, so are there things that get in the way of the light? Like, I don't know, the lens you see it gets distorted, the shadows on the wall, as Socrates might say, we're seeing a distortion of a distortion. Or put differently, we grow up from people who are supposed to show us what is good, and they're not quite there. They have their own flaws, their own history. As Carrie Underwood might say, daddy was a mean old mister, and that might distort it a bit. It doesn't even have to be parents for that to be a factor. I mean, let's say you listen to me and you find some of the things I say interesting, and then you see me doing something stupid or horrible on my worst day. You don't know the context, what I'm facing, but like, oh, what's this guy doing? Nothing he said is of value, right? It happens. We are only human, and we can only react to the people around us who try to model what is good and do so in a flawed way. For other people, it might be trauma that makes it harder for them to see something good. We see certain people and it reminds us, oh, that thing, it's just like that painful thing. Distorts the goodness that's there. It's possible, right? But anyway, it's interesting. A show like Preacher season finale is about the search for God. And yet to me, God felt so far away in that episode. You see the absence of him. You see loneliness and confusion and dissonance and anger and violence. Not so much love and kindness, or much that I would say is divine. On the other hand, you have something like It's a Wonderful Life. And God plays a role in the story. I mean, in the clouds, a little blinking lights. But that's not where I would say God might be, if he's there at all. I would say possibly it's in the way that George Bailey cares about the people in his life, the way that he respects his father, and the way that people care about him, that connection between people. Maybe God is there. Maybe a little bit of him is there somewhere. I want to end with two different songs to kind of summarize it. In It's a Wonderful Life, the song Hark the Herald Angels Sing comes up. And there's some really poignant lyrics in there. It goes, Born that man no more may die. I won't make you listen to me sing the whole thing, but goes on to say, hark, the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn king. A sense of something conquering death, of eternal possibility, but also of serving something greater than the self. In contrast, there's Leonard Cohen's song from his latest album, the last one that he produced before he died. It's a great album. I've played it on rotation a couple of times recently, and that one's called You Want It Darker. The first verse of that song ends with these lyrics. If thine is the glory, then mine must be the shame. You want it darker, we kill the flame. The question is not just which song tells a better story, but which song is the kind of story that we are more likely to help manifest with the things we say and do. I leave that for you to decide. Okay, that's our show. What are your thoughts? What's your approach to editing? Any films that you enjoy in the way that they are edited? You can let us know, leave a comment on the page, or shoot me an email. It's podcast@ncervides.com. We'll also include Hunter's Facebook page, so you can reach out to him that way if you want to learn more about editing or about what he does. If you find value in the show or find it interesting in some way, would you take a moment to let me know? I'd really appreciate it. This is the time of year that can be a little stressful, and I'll be honest, it's been a little more discouraging than usual. So if there's something that you appreciate, I would appreciate hearing from you. Just a sentence or two. You send in an email, podcast@ncervides.com, or you could leave a comment, a review on iTunes, help get the word out. Music for the show provided by Rob Coslow. It's the song True Gemini. Until next time, let's make our future collaborations be better collaborations.